You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nell.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Nell Sheline, a research fellow in the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington. And you were in the Biden administration State Department. You resigned, I gather, in protest over the administration's unconditional support for Israel during the war in Gaza. And you are now, in addition to finishing a book on religious authority in the Middle East, a fellow at the Arab Center of Washington, D.C., of the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston, and an adjunct faculty member at Georgetown University. And I'm really glad to have you on because you, as people might have inferred from that, know more about the Middle East than I do. And I want to, by the end of this conversation, I would like to have a clear idea of what the post-war Middle East might look like. I think most people think there will have been structural change. You know, 5 years from now, people look back and go, yeah, this wasn't just another year. This was, in some sense, transformative. Some people are talking about dramatic transformations, including of America's role in the Middle East, maybe even in the world. People are saying this could be our Waterloo as an empire, which I don't think is totally crazy, actually. I mean, if you believe we are an empire, and you could argue about the sense in which we are or not. But I do think this has the hallmarks of true transformation. So I thought I'd start by just giving my very short summary of like the last week, like where I think we are now. Then I'm going to let you step in and correct the things I got wrong, add anything you want to add. And then we will go from there and move from, you know, kind of the current situation, recent events, to imagining future Middle Easts, post-war and presumably post-peace deal Middle East, although it's far from clear that there will be a peace deal. There are other ways for wars to end. So here's where I think we are. As people know, one thing that happened as a result of this war is that Iran wound up with effective control of the Hormuz Strait. It could decide which boats got out. It started charging about $2 million a boat, which, you know, with oil tankers actually wasn't that much. That's like $1 a gallon or something. Pre-war price is $60, $65 a gallon. The war itself had gotten the futures markets up around $100 a gallon or more. And if you ask, if you don't look at the futures market, but what people are actually paying right now in the spot market for oil, it's well above $100. So, you know, we're talking about doubling the war itself, doubling the price of oil. So the dollar or to a barrel added by Iran's tax wasn't that much. What I think bothered the U.S. at least as much as that is just that they had control. They could decide who goes through and who doesn't. They could play favorites if they want. They could use it as leverage. And so we had this idea of a counterblockade, and it, unlike Iran's blockade, was going to include traffic into and out of Iranian ports. So in other words, Iran was now going to pay a price for the blockade. Trump said they would fold soon. Their economy couldn't stand it. They didn't fold as soon as he had hoped. So we decided to step it up and launch, I think it was called Operation Freedom. That was that what it was called? Very creative. Haven't we used that before? Anyway, the and it was a little unclear what that meant. It seemed so. Apparently, it finally did mean using naval warships to try to escort tankers through the strait or something. Iran fired on the naval ships, on the tankers, and for good measure on UAE, a very important facility they were using that helped them to some extent bypass the toll gate. So basically, Iran said, you know, we're willing to escalate pretty high here, are you? And Trump basically said, no. We've decided to end Operation Freedom. It was so wildly successful. We got two tankers out. But then I think part of his kind of cover story, and this brings us to today, was, also, these peace negotiations are just, I mean, we're this close to the finish line. This is going to be amazing, folks. And so what you've heard is that today, last check, I think we were maybe expecting Iran to reply to the latest American proposal, which, if the Wall Street Journal's account of it is right, is not very close to something Iran would actually accept. So that's where it seems to me we are. I think Iran actually demonstrated that it has what's technically called escalation dominance, and basically Trump chickened out, which I'm not criticizing. I encourage chickening out, especially with Trump. So that's where I, what would you do? Would you say there's anything wrong with my facts or my analysis? And in any event, what would you add and what would you say yourself?
I mean, I think your facts and analysis are all there. I think the broader question around, you know, what does this mean is an open question. I mean, as far as trying to get a sense of what's been going on, I think another crucial factor here is the dynamics within the Gulf, and in particular the fact that the UAE just left OPEC.
Right. That was about a week ago, and OPEC, of course, this oil kind of cartel that Iran belongs to, Saudi Arabia. The idea was they could collectively control oil prices in a way that they couldn't do individually because of a collective action problem. So it was a big deal when UAE said, screw you, we're getting out. That was last week.
Right, right. Because, I mean, so the UAE accounts for about 12 to 15% of OPEC Plus's production. But it is this broader question now, is OPEC, you know, will other countries also decide that right now at a time when a lot of countries, well, especially the Gulf countries, are struggling financially, are they also going to not want to be constrained by limits on their production? And it was a big signal of this rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. So to kind of go back to your question of how transformative is this moment or has this war been, I think it just accelerated trends that we were already seeing. So thinking about the fact that the UAE and Saudi Arabia had a big falling out over Yemen that came to a head in December, when you saw the fact that I'm going to go deep on Yemeni politics for a minute.
Sure.
The former North Yemen is controlled by the Houthis, and you had basically the Saudis and Emiratis supporting various groups in the former South Yemen. And there had been sort of somewhat of an equilibrium there. And in December, you saw the Southern Transitional Council, which wants an independent South Yemen, which existed briefly, to essentially establish control over all of the former South Yemen. And the Saudis said, this is unacceptable, and very quickly rolled all that back and told the Emiratis to get out of Yemen, which they did. But this was a very public falling out between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and was just the most visible manifestation of this ongoing rivalry mm-hmm. between them, which overthrows what had been for the past several years a dynamic whereby they were seen as working very closely together, including on things like the blockade of Qatar that lasted from 2017 to right before Joe Biden took office. And so the fact that now we're seeing the UAE leaving OPEC isn't a huge surprise. We know that the Emiratis had been expressing frustration with these production limits for a while. Mm-hmm. But I do think the timing is interesting, and it does appear to signal just the UAE being very clear about the fact that they are doubling down not only on the relationship to the Americans. We know Trump's upset about high gas prices. The UAE being willing to raise production theoretically could address some element of those higher prices. Although the thing that would really have been helpful is if Trump hadn't started this stupid war in the first place, mm-hmm. Or if he wanted to just allow Iranian oil to flow freely and not be sanctioned. And also them doubling down on the relationship with Israel. And so the fact that about a week or so ago, we learned that the Israeli Defense Forces were involved, you know, that Israel had sent troops to the UAE as it was dealing with, you know, the UAE dealt with by far the most attacks from Iran, followed by Kuwait. And, you know, knowing that it, from the calculus of Iran, the UAE is really on the side of Israel and the United States.
And we should say, you know, this whole Abraham Accords thing that kind of, I guess, Trump launched, but Biden more or less tried to sustain, which was to normalize relations between Arab nations and the Israel. Arab nations had traditionally refused to recognize Israel, citing in particular the unresolved Palestinian issue. But UAE, as I understand it, they had recognized Israel. Saudi Arabia had not. I guess Bahrain, had, I think, also recognized Israel. Is that right? So there was this division among the Gulf states. And in the case of UAE and Saudi, I guess there's an added fascinating personal dimension, which is that, you know, MBS and MBZ, right, the head of UAE, had been friends and allies. I think MBZ was a little bit of a mentor for MBS originally, who, of course, assumed de facto leadership of Saudi Arabia at a pretty young age, I don't know, a decade or so ago. But now there's been, you know, we don't know to what extent this is the struggle for, you know, who gets to be alpha male, but there is this personal dynamic there. In any event, so there's both a pre-existing, there was a developing fissure along personal lines. There's the pre-existing fissure by virtue of Israel. Saudi Arabia had not been willing to go so far as to recognize Israel until they at least had some kind of facade of, you know, Israel attempting to move toward a two-state solution or something. And Bibi wouldn't even utter the words insincerely that Saudi wanted to hear. So you had this structural difference to begin with. And I guess the OPEC thing kind of really cements that, right? It's like UAE is kind of doubling. I mean, you might ask, like, after this war, if you're a Gulf state and you've just discovered that not only do U.S. bases not protect you, they actually invite attack, you might say, well, you know, after the war, maybe we'll reconsider our relationship with the U.S. But UAE is basically saying, right, no, we're doubling down with Israel and the U.S. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. Everything you identified as far as the fact that MBZ was seen as having mentored MBS, although there's a certain perception that perhaps it was MBZ's sort of poor guidance that led to decisions like the 2015 invasion of Yemen, which
didn't go well.
Right. I mean, not only at the time, the largest humanitarian disaster in the world, but also just a big failure.
At that point, they were on the same team with respect to Yemen, right? Like, join our invasion, fine, but it didn't go well.
Exactly. And just, you know, other decisions that MBS made at the time, like kidnapping the prime minister of Lebanon. I mean, just ways in which MBS's sort of introduction to global attention was pretty rocky. There have been questions about to what extent was MBS listening to the guidance of Mohammed bin Zayed, wasn't giving such great advice. But this dynamic of, you know, your question about like who wants to be top dog in the region, that's certainly part of it. And a big part of that is Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030, that they, for the past 10 years, have been fundamentally transforming Saudi society. There's still a way to go, but I was just in a meeting. I mean, the Saudis are feeling pretty proud of themselves for everything that they've accomplished. And I think with good reason. I mean, you go to Saudi Arabia today and it is an entirely different country than it was. You know, women are working. I previously traveled to Saudi Arabia, didn't have to, but felt more comfortable covering my hair. Yep. You know, when I was there in December, didn't do that at all.
Was this in Riyadh?
Yes, this was in Riyadh.
I was there about, it must be close to 20 years ago now, but somewhere between 15 and 20, maybe. At that point, in Riyadh, and there was a difference between Riyadh and Jeddah. Jeddah is on the coast and more cosmopolitan. But in Riyadh, I don't think I saw the face of a woman outside of my hotel. Outside of like a Western-oriented hotel, they were all veiled, as I recall. And now Riyadh, it's in the heartland. It's conservative. It's kind of like America, you know. and Jetta was different, but that's transformative. If people aren't, are there probably Saudi women are at least still covering their hair, right, in Riyadh, but not necessarily.
Not even everyone. Yeah.
They're like driving cars.
They're driving. Yep. A lot of it is class based, which is something you see around the Middle East. You know, like sort of upper class women are less likely to cover their hair. You know, they're often more cosmopolitan. They're spending more time in spaces, you know, mixed gender spaces. But all that, yes, as you said, I mean, this is a huge and very rapid transformation for Saudi society. And while obviously the way they've gone about this is through extreme levels of repression, and I don't want to discount that, I do think in Saudi Arabia, you feel a lot of optimism. Young people who, you know, hundreds of thousands of young Saudis were sent abroad starting in kind of the early 2000s. And that whole generation, basically, of Saudi millennials under the King Abdullah Scholarship Program studied elsewhere and came home and said, we want a normal country. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Mohammed bin Salman has been in the process of doing. And there were a lot of questions around, like, you know, he's scaled back these mega projects like NEOM and all this stuff. And for the most part, those weren't the things that really are going to change the lives of ordinary Saudi people, but things like addressing unemployment, you know, allowing, just encouraging private sector development. A lot of these ways that sort of day-to-day life in Saudi Arabia has become less repressive because their extreme religious project of sort of enforcing Wahhabi Islam was very much a top-down autocratic project. Mm-hmm. And even though they haven't opened up any sort of political freedoms, to be clear, they have opened up more sort of social freedoms. And so I think many aspects of Saudi society are sort of breathing a little easier these days, despite ongoing political repression.
And of course, I guess you could say, I mean, UAE is certainly you know, modernized. I mean, Dubai in particular is, you know, is, I guess, the closest thing to the, I don't know what, the Las Vegas or something of the Middle East. So
I'd say it's a lot newer and shinier than Vegas is.
Yeah, I guess. I haven't been to Vegas in a while, but downtown, God knows, was not, could have used some, a little polish at that when I was there. So go ahead. So you have this, do you imagine, I guess, how deep and enduring do you imagine this divergence being? I mean, a lot of it between Saudi Arabia and UAE, because there's a lot of oil and money between the two of those, and both, as of now, are important allies of the U.S. And, of course, a lot depends on how the war winds up. And I want to get back to the question of, like, what does Iran want? What does the U.S. want? What does Israel want? But do you imagine that after this war, the split between UAE and Saudi is going to be deeper?
So, yeah, so the reason I talk about all that is to get at that question, because I do see them as really having very fundamentally divergent interests, because this path that Saudi Arabia is pursuing is to try to sort of leverage the fact that they actually do have a large population. I mean, some of what they're requiring are things like they're requiring companies, if they want to do business in Saudi Arabia, they have to have headquarters in Saudi Arabia. And so that means either they have dual headquarters in the UAE and Saudi, or they are shutting down their Emirati headquarters and insisting that if you want access to this big market, you have to have your HQ here. And so for the UAE, that's, you know, kind of a zero sum. And so, you know, this question of not only the UAE leaving OPEC, but it's also, you know, the GCC itself during this past war has...
This is the Gulf Cooperation Council. It's the...
Right,
this organization of Gulf Arab states, basically.
Exactly, which has long been dominated by Saudi Arabia. And that domination is part of why you've had other countries be hesitant to sort of invest the GCC with more power, because Saudi Arabia is so much bigger and stronger than any of the five other sort of wealthy members of the GCC. There's been that inherent dynamic, and I think this war has just made so clear that the UAE is going to go its own way. And going back to the question of the Abraham Accords, it was, as you said, the UAE normalizing with Israel and Bahrain normalizing, and then Morocco joined and Sudan joined. But you know, the white whale was Saudi Arabia, because mm-hmm. that would be symbolically so important, religiously so important. And we know that even at the start of the Biden administration, when initially Biden wouldn't even meet with MBS, you know, because of Khashoggi and the Yemen, you know, he was sort right. of, he was demonstrating his difference from Trump's close relationship to the Saudis by saying he wasn't going to meet with MBS. And then he had to sort of go and kiss the ring.
Mm-hmm.
But we know even from the beginning, Brett McGurk had been pursuing Saudi normalization with Israel. That was still seen as
an advisor within the Biden administration. And he's been in various other, including Republican administrations, right?
Yes. And so he is someone who's very in favor of Israel, in favor of the UAE, and sort of this theory of authoritarian stability in the Middle East, very supportive of U.S. policies vis-a-vis unconditional support for Israel in the genocide in Gaza. I mean, generally, I think the embodiment of what's wrong with a lot of U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East is someone like McGurk.
Can I stop and don't forget what you were going to say, but I have to ask you, given the fact that you did resign from the Biden administration protest, this kind of big question, which is, you know, Biden. As I said, he sustained more than I might have imagined the trajectory of the Trump administration on kind of Israel and the Middle East by really pursuing these Abraham Accords, this Arab normalization with Israel, even though, you know, people on the left and some other places were saying, wait a second, we've gotten no progress. If anything, the opposite on the Palestinian issue. And that was supposed to be a prerequisite. And Arab recognition was supposed to be one of the levers you use on Israel. But Biden went, I would say, more in Trump's direction than you might have imagined. Now, I will say he did that in other realms, too. You could say China, Cuba, you would have expected a little more of a reversal or course correction than you got with Biden. But let's just, you know, Israel is distinctive in its role in American politics. Do you have a theory of the case? I mean, you know, there are people who say, look, it was the Israel lobby. There are people who say, no, Biden always felt this in his heart. And then there are people who say it was a little of both. Biden didn't show up in the Senate originally feeling it in his heart. He just kind of learned the rules of the road. And the Israel lobby played a role, and so it became an instinct with him. Do you have a theory of the case here?
I mean, I do think it's a measure of both. I think that even if Biden perhaps didn't show up a committed Zionist, I think he became one. And there was this dynamic within the Biden White House whereby nobody could really tell him anything on foreign policy because he thought he knew more than anybody else did, or to the extent that he had the capacity, you know, if sort of limited capacity that anyone has, but especially someone more advanced in age, that a lot of that was just driven by people like McGurk and Sullivan, mm-hmm. such that.
So Sullivan is pretty strongly pro-Israel or whatever you want to call it for whatever reason, he just is. And I assume Blinken is too, but I don't know. I mean, would you put all three of them together?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, this was certainly the dynamic within the State Department where you had a lot of alarm and concern. You know, many people inside state are more accustomed to what you were saying, that the paradigm was sort of, well, we don't do, you know, the way you get to a better situation in Israel-Palestine, you use the leverage of Arab normalization with Israel. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but as you said, the Abraham Accords overturned all of that. And there was at the time this perception that the issue of Palestine is no longer relevant to the Arab public, you know, to ordinary people. And that's, you know, so Saudi Arabia should be able to just normalize, mm-hmm. as you said, even with just sort of a vague gesture towards some kind of Palestinian self-determination is really all that MBS really would have needed before October 7th and the annihilation of Gaza. So I think this is, as you were saying, there was so much continuity between Trump's foreign policy towards the middle, towards, you know, Trump and Biden on foreign policy looked so similar, including things like not reviving the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, mm-hmm. which Biden said he was going to do.
Well, yeah, Trump jettisoned it. Trump got us out of it. Yeah, I had Rob Malley on, you know, who is in the Biden administration, and we talked about Biden's taking a pretty hawkish position on negotiations early on in the administration, and after that, it was kind of almost too late to recalibrate. But anyway, so he failed to restore the Obama nuclear deal, which I think would have been quite doable if he had really set his mind to it.
Right.
And here we are. Well, as a result, but yeah.
Right. And he just jumped right back into the Paris Climate Accords. He could have just said, you know, just pretend like Trump didn't happen, which is what mm-hmm. he did on some things like the Climate Accords. He could have just been like, all right, Iran, we're just going to jump back in. Didn't do that, and here we are. So you know, I think but back to this question of kind of the overarching impact of this war. I think that, so what's funny is I had put out a brief for the Quincy Institute asking the question of, are Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who are the two largest purchasers of US weapons, are they rethinking their dependence on the United States? And this was in the context of genocide in Gaza, Israel striking Qatar, which at the time was seen as really beyond the pale. And, you know, now at this point, we've had mm-hmm. a whole war between now and then of Iran hitting all of the GCC states. But, you know, these dynamics were already at play. This question of, given that the U.S. seemed to be continually providing Israel with anything it wanted, such that it was committing genocide, it had invaded Lebanon, it was firing missiles on Qatar and Syria and Iraq, you know, that basic, and Yemen, that other countries were increasingly feeling more worried about Israel than they were about Iran back mm-hmm. at that right. time before the war.
Right.
And so I think those dynamics have just been really heightened by this. But now there is this question of, you know, Iran's regional power has been made manifest as a result of this. Yeah. And so now you have all these Gulf countries wondering what they do. And I think the answer is you have countries moving in different directions. So you have the UAE really doubling down on the relationship with the US and Israel. Saudi Arabia is working to sort of shift to export oil through the Red Sea. You know, Saudi is already involved in a lot of infrastructure. They were already mm-hmm. you know, they've got the port at Yanbu, which is north of Jeddah. They have a port at Neom, which does not do oil, but is already moving just more sort of cargo than it had been yeah. before the war.
They have some land infrastructure for exporting oil through the Red Sea rather than the Persian Gulf already, although Iran has kind of demonstrated that it can strike that infrastructure, the pipeline. And they will be developing more. And this was... as I think it was Rob Malley who was pointing out on the podcast, that control of the strait may be a slowly eroding asset from Iran's point of view, because if you give these countries a few years, and it will take a few years, but they will try to develop alternative infrastructures for delivering oil one way or another without the Persian Gulf. Go ahead.
So, you know, what there was in a meeting, where, you know, the Saudis are talking about everything they've been doing. And the question came up of, well, you know, is there a role for the United States here, given that, you know, the majority of the Saudi-China relationship is so much bigger and such a more important aspect of the Saudi economy than the U.S.-Saudi relationship is. And given the lowering value of the so-called U.S. security guarantee, all the Gulf countries, but Saudi in particular, well, all minus the UAE, are rethinking. They're trying to further diversify their security relationships. We have things like the Saudi-Pakistan Mutual Defense Pact, which was sort of upgraded, but then potentially adding Turkey to that, potentially adding Egypt. Maybe Qatar would get on board with that. Other Gulf states might also want to be involved. So the idea that the Americans were bringing up was going back to this idea of IMEC, the India-Middle East corridor, which the idea was to have also then incorporated Israel and Haifa as kind of, you know, you bypass Iran, you've got infrastructure connecting sort of Europe, and then the port of Haifa in Israel going through Saudi Arabia and like, and then all the way to India. And I think from
I didn't really realize this entirely. The U.S. was trying to develop a system, a more deeply rooted system for just completely isolating Iran economically.
Yes. Like,
sanctions weren't enough. The completely crippling sanctions weren't enough.
Completely crippling sanctions weren't enough, you know, developing the infrastructure. But this would also require Israel and Saudi Arabia to have normalized relations and, you know, fully sort of integrated oil infrastructure and everything. And one interesting so basically the Saudi, no one in the Gulf, I think, has been mentioning IMEC. I think the American administrations will sometimes and be like, do we want to go back to this? And I think the Saudi are sort of like, no. And part of it is because it's also a single point of failure again. It's, you know, if anything happens to the port of Haifa, mm-hmm. you know, like, again, it's you're looking at the same issues. So a lot of emphasis on sort of infrastructural redundancy, just having a lot of different ways, not only to move oil, but other products. I think another big emphasis was the recognition that there are the Gulf countries depend on imports. These are not places that sustain human life themselves naturally.
Yeah. No, they you know, they have to, if they weren't desalinating water, whatever the actual term is, you know, they don't even have enough water to sustain life by and large.
Exactly. You know, 98% of the water consumed in Dubai is from desalination plants.
Yeah.
So when it seemed like the war was going to start attacking, and there were some attacks on desalination infrastructure, and then I think it was recognized that, like, that you know, we do not want to deal with the repercussions, the humanitarian repercussions of, you know, millions of people without water, mm-hmm. That can't go anywhere.
So you're saying that dependency on imports, it means that they have to have enduring relations with some strong economic power or what?
Well, no, so the implication was that there's actually a lot more regional integration that should happen. And thinking about kind of the way the United States, and this was during COVID, you know, the idea of sort of onshoring, you know, not being so dependent on everything coming from, whether it's China, or I think in the Middle East, it's recognizing that, like, you know, between sort of Iraq, Jordan, the Gulf countries, maybe at some point in the future, Iran, if this could happen. Just sort of allowing there to be, you know, a truck can carry something, you know, agriculture that is grown in Iran can make its way to the Gulf countries, and you don't have to worry about who's controlling the seas. So that was interesting. I think a takeaway of more sort of onshoring production, consumption, not being so dependent. And I do think that's also this recognition of the possibility that the U.S. and China may be getting to a point where the U.S. is going to demand its partners and allies pick a side. And many, many countries in the world are not interested in having to make that choice. But I think in anticipation of that, they're looking to sort of, make sure we have access to our...
Well, and I would think after this war, they may well be less inclined than ever to pick the U.S. side. I mean, this could be very fundamental. I mean, we proved ourselves unable to defend these purported allies, and that's one reason they may evaluate their relationship with us. And I wanted to say kind of relatedly, one, you know, among the kind of glitches in the works with this apparent American scheme to further isolate Iran. You mentioned Turkey a couple of times, but, you know, if I'm Turkey, you know, like, so there was a time not so long ago when Israel was taking it for granted that they could take Iran off the board before this war played out as it has. And you were already starting to hear, and Turkey's next, because Turkey is like Iran, an actually big, kind of organically powerful country in a way that none of the Arab nations are, partly because of the population densities caused by the rainfall issues and so on. But Turkey's next. And then, you know, Israel's foreign policy has become more and more about just neutralizing, disempowering potential enemies as opposed to actual, you know, diplomatic achievements or even just mutual deterrence, just stable deterrence. It's more and more about like attacking and incapacitating potential enemies. And so you're hearing that about Turkey. But first of all, I'm thinking, man, Turkey, you know, that's a pretty big and pretty powerful country. But now, you know, and so like all along, I mean, as you said, first of all, the Arab states before this war were growing concerned about the foreign policy of Israel's that I just described. They seem to be going almost berserk, like bombing Syria just in case someday, there's, you know, the new regime was going to be Israel friendly. But they said, well, still, as a welcoming president, we're going to destroy all your military hardware, because who knows? You might change your mind. And you know, there was various other places that you mentioned that they were wrong. So the Arab states were more and more like, maybe Israel is a bigger threat than Iran to regional stability, which has seemed the case to me for a long time. But in any event, so you were starting to hear about kind of Arab-Iranian rapprochement. And I would assume that's one reason Israel welcomed this war, right? And yet, although in some cases maybe it's played out as they had hoped with UAE, that may have drawn them, if anything, closer to Israel, because Iran, partly because of the pre-existing UAE-Israel relationship, really focused on UAE and the retaliation. But you know, a lot of other states are kind of making up their mind. And one thing, like if you're Turkey, you're like, you know, Iran's looking like not a bad partner, right? Like, man, these guys have got some stamina. And so, it, you know, if Iran, if the regime hangs in there, if I'm Turkey, I want to consolidate ties with them, which would not be a crazy thing. I mean, over time, Turkey has been much closer to doing that kind of thing than a lot of the Arab states and so on. So anyway, this is to me the most kind of fundamental kind of realignment scenario suggested by the war, that you actually get a firming of ties between Iran and Turkey and between Iran and some of the Arab nations. You would know more than I do about which ones are most likely, if any, but what do you think about all that?
I mean, to start with Turkey and Israel's behavior, this is just, for me, another example of the moral hazard created by the United States providing Israel with unconditional support, no matter what, no matter how aggressively it behaves. And one important thing to keep in mind here, as you increasingly see Israel being such a divisive political issue in the United States, both among Democrats and Republicans, where the question is, you know, what's your stance on Israel? And that will, for, you know, this, you know, it's being seen as sort of a proxy for like, are you committed? Are you going to fight for me? You know, are you going to stand up to the vested class, to the donor class, which is all in for Israel, and the majority of Americans are no longer are. But so I think the Israel, and so this question of, in particular, you start to hear politicians saying like, well, no more, you know, aid for Israel, but we should provide them with defensive weapons. And I think that's a crucial thing to understand, that when we continue to provide them with like Iron Dome, they don't actually have to behave the way a normal country does. Like normally, if a country attacks another country, they need to be ready for that country to counterattack. And so if Israel has the capacity to attack other countries and then not really deal with the consequences, that incentivizes, like that's the moral hazard, that incentivizes more aggressive behavior, such that now they're looking at Turkey, which as you said, is kind of crazy, that they think they're going to take on a NATO armed, you know, a NATO ally. But this, I mean, this is how Israeli politics works right now, is just identifying the next target, really the next enemy, such that, you know, the erosion of, you know, the balance of powers, like consolidation of control in the executive, you know, people are not paying attention to that. And so obviously right now, Israeli society, there's really not a politician that looks willing to do anything that's very different than these extreme policies of aggression and really annihilation of the Palestinians. But I'm hopeful that as politics in the United States make it no longer viable for the U.S. to continue to send this unconditional military aid, that will lead to a shift in Israeli politics. But I think it's going to have to happen on the U.S. side first. And it's just a matter of how many people are they going to kill until we get there, which is a horrifying prospect. But as you said, I think it mattered in terms of like relations with Iran moving forward. I mean, we'd already had going back to, you know, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the United States, especially in Saudi Arabia, but other countries too, where they felt that the U.S. was not doing enough to help protect them from Iran or, you know, from the Houthis or whatever it was. And so you had this rapprochement and the de-escalation of tensions, especially, you know, the fact that the Saudis and Iranians normalized relations back in 2023 was a very big deal. And even though there was still a lot of skepticism, I think in the sort of Saudi foreign policy establishment, they didn't trust Iran, but they just felt in order for us to pursue our economic goals, which are big, I mean, Vision 2030 is about kind of transforming Saudi society and economy so it's no longer dependent solely on oil. We really just need calm in the region. We want to attract tourists. We want to attract investors. We want influencers. And that is not exclusive to Saudi Arabia. That's a model, obviously, the UAE has pursued, Qatar to a certain extent. And so this war has blown all of that out of the water. Like if it's no longer a safe place for investment, if travelers are second guessing whether it's a good place to transit through, you know, tourists aren't going to want to come. They are really looking at a fundamental rethink of how are our economies going to continue to function moving forward. So they are desperate to reestablish the sort of myth of stability, clearly, but to make it actually grounded in reality. And I do think in the long term, they understand that that will require better relations with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why they were unwilling, for the most part, to fire on Iran, to allow the U.S. to fire on Iran. Obviously, there's some contestation there, but the line they took and they were sticking to it was, Iran, we are not letting the U.S. use our territory to fire on you.
Mm-hmm.
And because you can't change geography, Iran's going to be there. So, you know, certainly countries like, you know, Oman wasn't mad about the idea of there being some kind of a toll or a fee that boats had to pay to go through the Strait of Hormuz that they would share with Iran. Obviously, the other Gulf countries were not in favor of that at all. You know, Qatar has historically had closer relations with Iran. I think the Qataris are very mad about the way that they were targeted and the extent, you know, the infrastructure damage that they sustained. You know, they're pretty mm-hmm. mad because yeah. they were like, we were the interlocutor here, Tehran. Like, why are you firing on us?
Yeah, I think this is relevant to the question of whether you can actually imagine Arab states winding up on one side or the other of the divide between kind of the Iran and Israel in the long run, is that they have reason to be pissed at everyone. You know, most of these Arab states really were asking Israel and the U.S. especially, like, don't start a war. We want a stable region. Trump exactly. attacked Iran. So right. they're not happy. They're obviously not happy when Iran retaliates against them. But, you know, they do have U.S. bases and the U.S. did attack them. And some of those bases were definitely being, you know. So, I mean, I think some people, you know, observe the war and think, well, we'll never see relations mend between Iran and any of these Arab states. And I'm just saying, look, the Arab states should be pissed at everybody right now. And they got to wind up on somebody's side at the end. So that's one reason this same thing seems to be a little more open-ended than some people think. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, and certainly they are extremely mad because they thought Trump was their guy. You know, you think to a year ago, Trump did his first trip of his second mm-hmm. term was...
No regime change wars.
Right. It was all music to their ears, and he was happily accepting the planes and the money and, you know, the investment in his cryptocurrency. Like, all the corruption was on full display. And the Gulf states really thought he was their guy. And then you get this. And I do think, you know, the war itself, this question of, you know, was he on a sugar high after Venezuela? I think that was part of it. Was it just the influence of Netanyahu plus the Israel lobby? I think that's a big part of it. I mean, the Israelis know, they see the writing on the wall as far as where U.S. public opinion is going, and they are pushing to grab as much as they can while they still have this U.S. support because they know it's limited, and they're trying to get the next MOU, although they're also trying to change it such that it's no longer sort of subject to congressional approval, that it's more sort of baked in and harder to roll back.
And that's an understanding about weaponry we will provide in the future, broadly speaking.
Well, and just the security assistance, mm-hmm. you know, that we provide them billions and billions of dollars every year. So we're coming up at the end of the 10-year MOU that Obama signed. And you know, you're starting to hear things like, you know, Israel shouldn't depend on the U.S. anymore. But that just means they just want to redo it in such a way that it's no longer sort of part of congressional approval. Uh-huh. Because they do want to bake in U.S. support in such a way that even as the politics and subsequently the politicians take new positions and are no longer in favor of open-ended unconditional support for Israel, that they'll have already sort of baked it in for another 10. They wanted like a 20-year agreement. So that's still an open question of kind of to what extent, like what are we going to see on that? And I'm really hopeful that American politicians won't just commit to more and more support for Israel, because then we're just going to continue to see these kinds of wars.
Yeah, there is that argument that they needed, that it would have been better for Israel in the long run to have had a little more in the way of tough love and a little less in the way of unconditional love from the U.S. in various senses, I think. But, you know, including cover at the U.N. and so on. But so listen, as you know, Anel, the structure of these podcasts is that we talk for a long time in public, as we've just done. Then we keep talking, but that is available, the overtime segment, to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes that will allow people to become one of those. Or you can go to nonzero.org and find a lot of our content, but including this post for this conversation. And right there, you can sign up as a paid subscriber and watch the rest or listen to the rest or set up your podcast feed so that you'll always have automatic access to the overtime. I wanted to give you, before we go into overtime, a chance to say where people can find your work. Of course, as somebody at Quincy, sometimes your stuff shows up at Responsible Statecraft, which is kind of the blog/magazine, more like a magazine, of the Quincy Institute. What else? Social media handles and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Anel Scheline, on Instagram at Anel Scheline. You can find my writing. You mentioned my book. I just sent it to the manuscript to Cambridge, so that'll be coming out next year.
Great. Do you have a title?
Yes.
Are you disclosing it publicly, or you're like...
No, it's called Weaponizing Tolerance, Arab Monarchies, and American Support for Moderate Islam.
That's that. I can imagine some of the dimensions that gets into. That sounds good. Weaponizing tolerance is a good thing. You know, weaponizing interdependence caught on. I think we could have a whole slew of good sounding things that get weaponized. And yours would be number two on the list. Okay, that's great. Anything else you want to say before we go into overtime?
If people are interested, they can find my work, including that the brief that I wrote about the Saudis and Qataris rethinking their reliance on the U.S. that was published literally 2 days before the U.S. Hacked Iran. So, you know, all of those dynamics are only sort of deepened now. That's at the Quincy Institute website.
Okay. So, yeah, I want to get into some of that when we get into overtime and kind of the question of which countries are most likely to go the way of UAE and more closely, if anything, identify with Israel and perhaps the U.S., but that'll be in overtime, and we're going there now. Thanks, everybody who stayed with us this long. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.